From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. To sleep, perchance to dream. Sleep and dreaming have been fascinating human beings since we could communicate. But we know very little about why we sleep, what goes on when we sleep, or even what sleep is for. David K. Randall, a senior reporter at Reuters, writes about the science of sleep in his new book, Dreamland, in the Strange Science of Sleep. That's Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. David K. Randall, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
David Randall's with us from the NPR studios in New York City. You got interested in sleep after a near disastrous sleepwalking incident. What happened?
You can say the topic literally hit me in the face. I started sleepwalking, and I woke up in the middle of the night, you know, terrible pain in my knee, on my back in the hallway, and, you know, quickly realized, hey, I sleepwalked into a wall. And if you haven't done it, it really hurts. I do not suggest doing it yourself. So I went to a sleep scientist. I went to my doctor, and I said, hey, you know, I'm sleepwalking. What can you do for me? And we'd spent a night in sleep lab and all that. And he basically said, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. There's a lot we know about sleep, but there's a lot we don't know. So just try to take it easy and see what happens.
Had you done sleepwalking before your accident?
That was the first time I sleepwalked, or at least the first time I did it so badly that I ran into something and woke up. But before that, I had, you know, I talk in my sleep, I kick in my sleep, I laugh in my sleep, all of these other things that drive my wife crazy.
What do you talk about?
I think I just say gibberish, basically. My college roommates still tease me over the fact that one night I sat up and I yelled, man, the barricades, the bacon is coming. And I have no idea where that came from.
Not bacon, apparently.
Apparently. I don't know what was going on.
So you talked to scientists about the impact of sleep and also the impact of not sleeping. And it's pretty scary what happens to us if we don't sleep. What goes on in our bodies?
Exactly. Our bodies pretty much tend to break down. After you go 6 hours of sleep, you go six hours of sleep or less, you basically start to act drunk. Your reaction time slow, your memory slows down, you're going to make poor decisions. And then if you continue this over your long, you know, chronically, it can lead to, you know, a rogue's gallery of health disorders, heart attack, stroke, obesity, everything you can think of, basically. And if you go too long without sleep, you know, the longest somebody went without sleep documented was 11 days. And this was a teenager in San Diego in the 1960s. And after about 11 days, his mind had basically turned against itself. He was seeing phantom visions, was hearing phantom sounds. It was like a very bad acid trip, which was even stranger by the fact that once he went to sleep, it all cleared away.
This connection of lack of sleep and obesity, I find really, really interesting. Do scientists know why there is that connection?
That's one of the things about sleep. They see all these connections, or they see all these correlations, but they don't necessarily know why. Part of the theory is that sleep is when our bodies just kind of repair themselves on a hormonal and a cellular level. Perhaps by taking that time away of healing, we're just more geared to wanting to eat carbohydrates and other things that kind of lead to obesity. But there's not an easy A leads to B correlation yet.
Got a question about sleep. David K. Randall, senior writer for Reuters, is with us. He's done an extensive project on this that ended up in his book, Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep, where he talked to sleep scientists around the world. We're at 206-543-5869, 800-289-5869. If you'd like to write to us, it's conversation@kuow.org. We don't even know the answer to the basic question of why we sleep, do we?
That was one thing that surprised me. You know, I expected science to have as, you know, thorough understanding of sleep as it does of digestion or any other thing that seems like, oh, obvious, that's why we need it. But scientists know, you know, what happens when we don't sleep, but it doesn't necessarily answer the reason why we sleep. One biologist, you know, famously said that if sleep doesn't fulfill an absolutely necessary function, then it's the greatest mistake evolution ever made. And we still don't know what that function is.
Are there any theories on what that function might be? What are the kind of contenders out there? Or are scientists just utterly baffled?
The biggest contender is that it's a time when we basically readjust our bodies. That a famous study with rats decided to say, what happens when a rat stays awake for 2 weeks straight? And the answer is it dies. And it dies in a pretty disgusting, gnarly way. You know, it develops sores that don't heal. Its fur starts to fall out in clumps. And the scientists did autopsies, and lo and behold, they could see no real reason why the rats died. The best reason they could come up with was perhaps that the lack of sleep just made it so that the rat could no longer maintain its body temperature at the same rate. And perhaps that's the same thing for us. Sleep also is key to, scientists think, dreams especially help us learn, help us kind of consolidate the information we've pecked away each day and find out what we should keep and what we should throw away.
David Randall, I learned from reading Dreamland that there is a score for sleeping. It's called ZQ. What is it?
Exactly. This was a company. It's called the Zio. And what they do is it's a brainwave monitor that you can wear over your head each night and basically tracks how long you've spent in each of the stages of sleep. And then kind of gives you a score each night so you can quantify it and say, okay, I slept 78 last night. I could slept 100 this night. I personally never got over 100. The top is about 150. But the idea is that it's no longer this idea of, hey, how did I sleep 3 weeks ago or 3 nights ago? I kind of don't remember. It's a way I can look at the data and say, oh, okay, I realized that I stayed up late too long, or I ate a big meal, or I had too many beers, or whatever, and that's what's made me sleep poorly that next night. I can see it on a scale.
We are a notoriously sleep-deprived people. It's a consistent problem and comes up all the time. We've got Sky on the line from Beacon Hill with a question about sleep. Sky, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm a healthcare professional, and I do a lot of 24-hour calls. And many of those 24-hour calls, I'm actually awake for a full 24 hours, or I only sleep 2 hours here or 45 minutes there. And there's sort of this persistent culture in medicine to continue having people do 24-hour calls. And all of us who do 24-hour calls have a sense that probably this isn't the best idea, but we, you know, continue to do it. So my question is, what is the long-term impact of 24-hour calls on our bodies, and what is the short-term impact? And I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your phone call, Sky. Do we know the answer to that, David?
Oh, that's a great question. The long-term impact, the scientists have basically looked at medical professionals to look at these studies, because there's a chance that medical professionals in the first place might live healthier lives. So one research study that looked at nurses over 25 years or so, and these were nurses who worked the night shift, they were found to be more likely to develop certain types of cancer. And the idea basically was that perhaps if they were staying up so long, their body was making less melatonin, which is a hormone that basically puts us to sleep. And if that melatonin was not, you know, manufactured in the right way, perhaps it impacted estrogen levels. So long-term impact, there's a chance that, you know, greater chances of cancer, greater chances of other health disorders. Short-term, it's harder just to make good decisions, basically. And one study looked at doctors who were, you know, on the 36-hour shifts for their residency. When they were driving home, the longer you had spent at a hospital, the more likely you were to get into an accident on the way home.
Another group of people that experiences sleep deprivation are people with young children. And I happened to be visiting some friends of mine who just had a baby, and they had that kind of semi-conscious look about them of barely being awake. And their theory was, they said that they had learned that babies are on like a maximum hour and a half sleep cycle, whereas adults are on a 2-hour sleep cycle, a recipe for disaster. Is that true?
Well, I can relate. I'm one of them. I have a 2-month-old baby at home. It takes a while for our brains to understand a 24-hour day. You know, before a baby is about 2 months old, he or she doesn't know the difference between night and day. And their sleep cycles are about 60 minutes long, as opposed to an adult has about a 90-minute cycle. So a baby will wake up, especially until they get to be about 4 or 5 months. It'll be very rare for them to sleep for more than 4 or 5 straight hours. They don't get that, you know, 8-hour block that we think of as normal now.
David Randall is my guest. He wrote Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. We're at 206-543-5869. It's toll-free, 800-289-5869. Write to us, conversation@kuow.org. I also learned from your book that in the final, deepest stage of sleep, REM sleep for random eye movement, your body is actually sending out hormones to paralyze itself.
Exactly. That's the reason why we don't act out our dreams. When REM sleep was discovered in, you know, the 50s and 60s, at first researchers thought that something was wrong with their instruments. They thought, okay, look at these brainwaves. It looks like this person is awake, but I look in the window and I can see that this person is asleep. That's when they realized they walked in and they kind of shined a flashlight in the person's eyes and they saw the eyelids dancing back and forth, and that's where their kind of rapid eye comes from. The researchers kind of call this paradoxical sleep because the brain is as active as it is when we're awake, but we're just trapped in our bodies, basically. And this is when most dreams occur. And this could also be when the time when our body, our brains, kind of find connections between what we learned every day and what we already know. That's why dreams might have all these, you know, things from your long-term memory as our brains frantically search for connections.
This thing about sleep paralysis, though, is just fascinating to me. What else did you learn about it?
It was actually in the Middle Ages, there was this idea that an incubus would sit on your chest and you would wake up. And this was called old maid's syndrome, basically. And the idea was that you were able to wake up at a time when your brain, your body thought you were sleeping. So you woke up and you felt paralyzed. You couldn't move. And it was terrifying. The same thing happens now with some people who sleepwalk or what's called REM sleep behavior disorder, when their bodies, you know, should be paralyzed when they're dreaming and they're not. And this can lead to people, you know, walking into, you know, sitting up on in their beds bellowing show tunes. Or there's this one case of somebody in Minnesota. He walked out into a blizzard in the middle of the night with no shoes on and walked around the block three times. Comes back in, you know, gets back in his bed. That's when he wakes up and realizes, hey, my bed's wet. How did I wet the bed for the first time in my adult life? You know, pulls back the covers and he has frostbite.
Oh, my God.
So the body has all these other strange scales between consciousness and unconscious that we really, few of us recognize.
John's listening to us today. He's got a real practical question about eating before bed. He said he's in the habit of eating late, right before bed. And he writes, I've heard people say that this is unhealthy for digestion and can interrupt sleep. I've always doubted this, as often after lunch I might get really sleepy, which seems to contradict that. So is it bad to eat before bed? And if so, why do we get so sleepy after we eat at lunchtime?
That's a great question. And I'll take the second part first. The reason we get sleepy after lunchtime is that we all have a circadian rhythm, which is basically a 24-hour clock that's internal. It's a little bit longer, but it's basically 24 hours that tells us when to get up and when makes us naturally tired and naturally makes us sleepy. That's why, you know, if we didn't have electric lights, most of us would wake up around 9 o'clock or so. We get sleepy around 2 o'clock. You know, that's in Spain and other places. That's when the siesta generally happens. Then you get the second shot of energy about 6 p.m., and then it takes you till about 10, and then you would fall back asleep naturally. So that kind of 2 p.m. after lunch feeling is natural. That's when many of us want a coffee, want to be very easy to take a nap if we worked at a place that allowed us to take naps. Then the idea of eating before you go to bed, it kind of depends on what you're eating, to be honest. If you're drinking alcohol, that sugar will metabolize over the night and it'll keep you up. It might make you fall asleep quicker, but then you're not going to be in a deep sleep all night long. But for other people, you know, eating something might just be what's called a sleep cue. It makes it easier for you to fall asleep. The same way that some people like to have the TV on or the radio on or something else that just kind of tells their body, okay, you can relax now. It's okay to kind of let go.
Yeah, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich worked for me when I was 6 or 7. Bang, I was out right after that. That took care of it. You're right that sleep.
Exactly.
You're right that sleep is more comfortable than ever today and yet more elusive. I want to go to the first part of that sentence. You've got some kind of remarkable stories about how sleep was so difficult back in the day. What were some of the ways that people had to sleep in earlier ages?
Well, generally, I mean, we think of everybody should have their own mattress now. But at the time, you know, Middle Ages or so, there might only be one mattress for the family. And that was where everything in your life really occurred. That's where you came into the world and where you went out of it. So it was very common for a family before they went to bed, you know, to check the room for mites and rats and everything else. Then workers in Victorian times, you know, they in workhouses, they would sleep in a long line, almost basically sitting on a pew with their arms dangling over a rope that was tied tight in front of them. And they paid for this privilege, which implies that it was better than the alternatives.
That's an amazing image. Let's go to Mark. He's listening to us today in Bellevue. If you just tuned in, my guest, David K. Randall, his new book is called Dreamland: Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Mark, what's your question?
I'd like to have him talk a little bit about the concept for those of us who will get very tired. 9 or 10 o'clock will come around, we'll fall dead asleep, but then 11:30 or 12, we'll wake up, and that's it, till maybe 3 in the morning when we finally fall back asleep again.
Do you have any ideas for Mark?
That's a good question too. Part of it could be that, you know, naturally we're not built to sleep 8 straight hours. The researchers discovered this in the late 80s, early 90s, when they discovered, you know, looking through historical records, old plays, Canterbury Tales, all these other things, they started seeing references to the first sleep and the second sleep. So at the same time, a psychologist in Maryland decided to say, what happens when we sequester people away from electric lights? And after the first couple of days, people slept as much as they wanted, you know, 14 hours, kids in a candy store. But after that time, that's when they started falling asleep around 10 o'clock and then waking up around 1, staying awake for an hour or so, and then going back to bed. And this, at the time, you know, before electric lights, this was expected. It was the idea that you're supposed to wake up in the middle of the night. And it was an enjoyable part of the night. That's when people would think about their dreams, would read, would have sex, you know, what have you. And the idea that we do this still suggests that it's a natural part of our brains that we're not allowed to do because of electric lights. So many people turn to sleeping pills when they wake up. You know, they go to bed at 10, they wake up at midnight and think, hey, well, I'm awake now. Well, it could just be this kind of historical pattern reestablishing itself, and medicating that might not be the way you want to go.
David, the demographics of sleep, the old wives' tale is that old people don't need as much sleep as young people. Is it true?
Well, generally, their sleep patterns change as you age. You know, teenagers find it impossible to go to bed before about 11 o'clock and impossible to wake up before 7 or 8 in the morning. And that's because their circadian rhythm has shifted. As you age, your circadian rhythm shifts as well. So you might go to sleep at 9 o'clock and then wake up at 3 and be up for a while and then go back to bed again. So it's not necessarily the amount of time, it's what time you're getting it. You're getting it in different chunks.
Now, there's been a move here in Seattle to try to change the start times of schools and some pushback because of the expense involved. But there is a lot of research that shows that young people really have a hard time getting up early, isn't there?
Exactly. And there's research that shows that there's clear benefits of moving that first starting bell back. At one high school in Minnesota, the year that they changed the starting bell from about 7 o'clock to, you know, an hour and a half later or so, their SAT scores jumped by about 20-25%. And it was such a big jump that the College Board, the company that administers the SAT, investigated, saying, what could there be that did this? And the only thing they could pinpoint it on was the extra sleep.
So much more to talk about, but we have run out of time, including why sleep researchers believe they are in the golden age of their field. We're going to have to leave it there for now. David K. Randall, I've enjoyed our talk.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
David K. Randall, the author of Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Leslie McClurg, Nick Visser, and Molly Williams. Andy Hurst is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
I've lived enough.